And there I am back at number two, processing physically terrible pain and grief. But it's part of healing. It's part of the healing. And that's another point that I can bring up now, and that is that in what we learned, people are never totally free of their grief, but they can heal. You're not cured, but it might help you heal. That there might be a subjective change in the midst of your grief and suffering, even though the suffering isn't gone. And by spiritual, we learned open to dimensions of faith and awe and uplift and reverence and ritual that cross all kinds of boundaries of Orthodox religions.
Greetings and love, you beautiful humans. It's Ben. Our guest this week is none other than Stephen Hardy, my dad. He's an historian by profession, but in his retirement years, he has taken to learning more about grief and grieving so as to offer guidance and wisdom to others who, like him and my mother, have experienced tragic loss. They say death and taxes are the only two certainties in life. And indeed, not only does death arrive for us all, it seems inevitable that everyone experiences the loss of a loved one at some point in their life. So this episode focuses on loss and the process of grieving and the healing that can come from that process. I hope you take something from it. Welcome back to Terrain Theory. All right, we are live. Steve Hardy, Pops, welcome to the Terrain Theory podcast.
Honored to be here, guys.
This is a treat to the listener. This is my father. And we thought that the timing was perfect because we talked a lot about grief and loss and processing grief in the last episode, the wellness check episode that Mike and I did. And it's Thanksgiving. We've got Thanksgiving coming up, and both Mike and I will be traveling home to Durham. Dad, I'm going to see you actually tomorrow.
Can't wait. Can't wait.
So hopefully nothing is said here that, you know, we can't lay the groundwork for
it was all over 3 days.
That's right. So I guess we could start, as we always do, just a brief backstory on Steve Hardy, my father.
Well, I mean, to fit with the theme here, I tell people that I live something like a charmed life, lucky, very lucky, growing up in a Waltham outside of Boston, in a nice neighborhood, in a very comfortable family setting. And life seemed like it was just going to unfold. And more or less it did, without a lot of thought. It unfolded all the way through college and graduate school, and I more or less stumbled on a path toward studying the dimensions of sport and society at UMass as a graduate student. I went undergrad to Bowdoin and was a Latin major. Knew I wanted to teach somehow and coach. I had known that from gym class in junior high school. That area of life interested me. But I didn't really know how I would approach it. And as I say, I stumbled along and had some success. And we had three wonderful boys. I married the love of my life, who I had known since the fifth grade. And things just unfolded. And we moved around. We lived on Cape Cod. That's where Ben was born. Josh was born in Amherst. And then Nate was born on Cape Cod. And then I got an academic job. I was very lucky to get a job as a assistant to the commissioner of what was then the biggest athletic conference in the East. And certainly my main job was hockey. And that's where all the action in Eastern College hockey was. And I got that because I had coached at Amherst College when I was a graduate student at UMass. And so one lucky thing after another. And then I got a job at the University of Washington teaching sports studies and sport management. Just perfect. Friends out there really lined the job up for us. And we moved out there, and I think it was a good 3 years. The boys were able to enjoy a wonderful area that at the time was a place you could afford without a lot of money. You can't do that now out in Seattle, but you could then. And then another job opened up in Pittsburgh, where I think Ben would agree, our boys lived in one of the great neighborhoods you could ever imagine as a kid. And it was almost idyllic. And then a job opened up at UNH. And in some degrees, it was a dream come true for 3 years. And then the hammer came down the first time. And so for the first time in my life anyway, things didn't make sense. Josh was diagnosed with grade 4 brain tumor, glioblastoma. And now what do you do? And we did, I think, what most families do. You just do what you think you have to do, and you stumble along. But life was no longer making sense. It just wasn't making sense. And Josh fought a courageous battle that I've written about. We can talk about that if you want. But he died after 17 months, beating the odds. And we all tried our best to put the pieces together. Donna, me, Ben, and Nate. It wasn't easy. And Ben went off to have a very successful career at Middlebury. And Nate went on to become a Navy SEAL. And things seemed to be going in a normal, so-called normal direction for us again. And then 2008, the world crumbled again. Nate was killed in action. And never did we ever begin to think lightning would strike twice like that. And I think Ben feels the same way. And so I began to look at life quite differently, that normal life was not peaches and cream. Normal life was struggle and loss and grief. And eventually, when I retired from UNH in 2014, I wanted to have some kind of purpose. I enjoyed teaching, and I'm talking about professional purpose, not as a parent or a spouse, but some kind of professional purpose. And so we had a wonderful pastor at the church in Durham, Mary Westfall. And talking with her, I realized that helping people in grief might be a sense of purpose. It wouldn't be limited to people in our church, but for obvious reasons, face to face, it would be people in the local area. And so that's what I've been doing since 2018. And I, as I mentioned, I took this online graduate certificate course from the University of Wisconsin. And it was a summer course over, probably 6 weeks. If you ever had an online course to take that was well managed and well operated, this was it. They really knew what they were doing. And there were probably, there may have been 16 people or 20 people, almost all of them except me were counselors who wanted to have a little deeper understanding about grief counseling. But they let me in after they learned my background. And we worked, we had sessions, we had tapes, we had interaction, and we learned just a whole lot. And that has completely oriented my approach toward understanding grief and toward trying to help groups of people. I'm not a counselor. It's like you guys and your appropriate disclaimer. You're not doctors. I'm not a counselor, but I'm pretty good at facilitating groups of people helping themselves. And that's the difference. I would never sit down with someone and act like I'm a one-on-one therapist, because I'm not. But there's a difference between that and facilitating groups of people trying to help themselves and each other.
It's a funny line when you think about it, that line between I am a professional therapist and having to make that disclaimer that I am not, when in real life, any conversation you have with an individual that starts to get into their background and their any sort of trauma or grief, you are a de facto therapist just by listening. I mean, we all perform that act of therapy simply by listening to our friends and family.
Well, Ben, you bring up a very, very important point, and we can get into this. There's an abundant literature on grief and resilience. That's a concept we can talk about. And the research shows that maybe the number one component of resilience is having what's called an expert companion.
Mm.
And you know what an expert companion is?
Someone with a degree?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. Because someone like with a degree is more prone to tell you something.
Mm.
An expert, and you know a few people, you too know a few people with degrees. An expert companion ultimately is a good listener.
Yeah. So you really, you need a good friend.
You need a good friend. And Carl Rogers, a famous psychologist, talked about four qualities needed in a helper or an expert companion. Congruence, that is, that doing what you're saying. In other words, if you're interacting, you're living that life, walking the walk, so to speak. Empathy, in other words, working hard to try to feel the other person's feelings and the other person's pain as your pain. Unconditional positive regard. In other words, really being good at not saying something that the other person might interpret as critical.
Hmm.
All unconditional. And that's one thing they taught us at Wisconsin. We would have to read someone else's response to a question. And we had to be very careful to be just positive in this environment, for sure.
Yeah.
And then showing congruence, empathy, unconditional positive regard. An expert companion. You don't need a lot of subject matter knowledge. You just need the knowledge of being a good companion. And that makes all the difference.
It does make all the difference. So as you came out of this grief course, or even while you were in it, did you have moments when you reflected on the journey as a father losing Josh and Nate and go, oh, I did that all wrong, or, you know, I really missed some of these steps? I mean, how did you first apply these learnings to yourself?
We had exercises, and they were all from my own experience. Yes, yes. The answer is yes. I've written about it. I mean, if you want, we could talk about approaches to grief, the two main ones out there.
Yeah.
And then we could get into what you're talking about. So
yeah, well, let me just preface this for the listeners, so they can go grab some more context. So you've talked about Josh and Nate, and Mike and I talked about this a bit on the last episode. And we also mentioned your website, StephenHardyWriter.com, where you've been writing to commemorate the 30th anniversary of Josh's Make-A-Wish trip to Seattle. This is the final trip he took just months before passing. And it's been so many things reading the blog, but living this experience through your eyes as a father now, I think is one of the most eye-opening and challenging things. And thinking, where could you have found the time? Because you have to pick up, you have to continue forward as a father. You've got to continue your job. You got to continue, maintaining a household. You still have to be a father to two surviving sons. Where would you find that time to grieve and process? I mean, I remember clearly my missteps along the way right after Josh died and in the sort of months and years that followed. But, you know, maybe you can touch on that as we get into the two approaches to grief here. Cause that's what blew me away, was just trying to walk in your footsteps as a father and going, I don't know how you did it.
I don't either. You do what you have to do. And I think most fathers, most parents, and siblings, you do what you have to do, and you don't always know what you're doing, but it's what you feel you have to do. And there's no right way or wrong way. Over the course of our lives, I hope we all learn maybe better ways to deal with things. But get back to the book you bought me, The Four Agreements, Ben, a long time ago. Those are still valid, aren't they?
Always valid.
You don't need to judge yourself, and you don't need to judge others. It doesn't pay off in any way for anybody. But to the two basic approaches of grief out there, at least in our Western understanding, people will talk about stages of grief that grew out of a wonderful book on death and dying by Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, on death and dying, not about surviving. And that's denial, anger, bargaining, depression, acceptance. And the problem with that is, again, it was based on in-depth research on people with terminal disease, not the survivors. So in that respect, it doesn't make a lot of sense, but people continue to use it. And if it's helpful for them, fine. What we learned is what most counselors use, and that's called Warden's Tasks of Grieving. And I've written about those in the blogs this summer. William Warden. So task one, and there's no necessary order, although task one typically makes sense, and it does jive with Kubler-Ross's last stage. Accept the reality of loss. Accept the reality of loss. Until you do that, it's hard to do much else. I mean, when particularly with Josh, we had a long time to prepare for the reality of his death. With Nate, we didn't. And we all thought, oh, he's just on a secret mission, Team 6 secret mission, and someone screwed up, and he'll show up. Mm-hmm. Well, he wasn't going to show up. We had to accept that. Task two, process the grief and pain. Experience it. Many people push it off, and that's something that it may work temporarily, but you're going to have to deal with it eventually. There's a task. Task three, to the extent possible, where possible, adjust to the world without your loved one in it. In other words, if you, and I wrote about this in the blog, I used to love to have cigars with Ben, Nate, Uncle Earl. Josh was too young to enjoy cigars. I know he had clandestine cigarettes with his friend, but he wasn't having a cigar with us. And I loved that. But that slowly, Earl quit smoking, Ben quit smoking, Nate died. Nate and I loved to have cigars together down in Virginia Beach. And he always had these Romeo and Juliet special expensive cigars. And he died. And so now what? I mean, it seems like a trivial thing. Mm-mm. But I learned to really enjoy having a cigar with Ben's Uncle Bobby up at the lake and Dave and others. And so that's just a tiny little example, as trivial as it may seem. It means a lot to me, that tiny bit of adjustment. And we all have plenty of ways to make adjustments if possible and practical. And task four, which for me anyway, is the most complex, is to find ways to maintain a connection with our loved one while embarking on our own life, while moving forward, so to speak. And there are lots of rituals that can serve this purpose. And I think that's where you get into real rituals. So for us, I've written about this. January 6th, Marginal Way, Ogunquit. a favorite place for Josh and his surfing buddies in Ogunquit Beach. So every January 6th, starting January 6th, 1994, the four of us, Ben, Nate, Donna, and I, went up there to try to experience a place Josh loved. Because we knew from stories that January 6, 1993 was a snowy, spitty, cold day. And some of his friends drove up there because they knew he loved it. And the moment they got to this high spot on the marginal way, the skies cleared, the sun came out. I mean, you kidding me?
Yeah.
And then as they walked, you were one of them, Mikey?
Yeah.
Wow.
Reading the blog last week, it gave me more specificity as, because, you know, it was just a rush of emotion, right? But remembering that we were allowed to leave school, like I didn't really remember that detail. And as me and Hunt Howell, specifically, we were probably driving together. I remember that, you know, the cold whipping wind and rain, and then the sky opening up with sunshine vividly, but it was lost on me till you jogged my memory.
I think there were a bunch of people who went up there too.
Yeah, there were a lot of us, but it was me and Hunt specifically, because every January 6th, I make sure I connect with Hunt over that.
And I think it was Owen and maybe Murph. Yep. As they walked from that high spot toward Perkins Cove, there's a cedar tree that wraps over the walkway like an arbor. And a big old crow was sitting in it, and it never left. It just caught at him.
Yeah.
And they said to themselves, you never know. And that's the kind of spirit we seek every January 6th when we get there. There have been some we haven't been able to get there, and it's getting harder for me. But that's a ritual. In other words, we're able to move forward. It's not a sad thing for us to do that. It's part of our life now. But it's a way to keep a connection with Josh. And going to Arlington National Cemetery as close to February 4th as we can is a similar ritual we have with Nate. So these tasks, they're not in any particular order, and they keep popping back. It's not a box to check off. I keep moving back and forth through these over and over and over again. I can hear a song that reminds me of Josh, or it may be a Metallica, or Amon Amarth would remind me of Nate. Mm. And there I am back at number two, processing physically terrible pain and grief. But it's part of healing. It's part of the healing. And that's another point that I can bring up now, and that is that In what we learned, people are never totally free of their grief, but they can heal. You know, this rather than the medical approach. There's a medical approach. It could be psychotherapy or drugs, and those can save people. With the idea that you're cured, you're not cured from grief. We learned a spiritual approach that is linked with healing. You're not cured, but it might help you heal, that there might be a subjective change in the midst of your grief and suffering, even though the suffering isn't gone. And by spiritual, we learned open to dimensions of faith and awe and uplift and reverence and ritual that cross all kinds of boundaries of Orthodox religions. So that's the approach I've learned.
Yeah, the parting clouds and the crow as a sign, you know, a sign from the spirit world or whatever you want to interpret it. I would say that's the approach I'd gravitate towards. Within Warden's tasks of grieving, I want to talk about that first one, accept the reality of loss. Are there within each of these tasks, like steps or processes you can take to achieve that, as it were?
Well, I mean, we learn different exercises that some people might use. one of the problems with that is you have to be real careful. These are things, remember, that therapists and counselors were learning in the class to use one-on-one. Mm. So I've learned over time, for instance, one of the exercises was to accepting the reality of loss would be to write letters of to your loved one there you are. There's the chair you always sat in, but now you're not there anymore. Mm-hmm. That sort of thing. But I also learned, and there's a book that takes some of these ideas and emphasizes if you're going to use an exercise, you need to do it with an expert companion. So don't do it yourself. Do it with an expert companion, all of these. And over time, I've learned to, in the groups that I run, that you have an expert companion if you're trying to do something like this.
So even if the writing the letters to your loved one seems like a very personal act, how would you include your expert companion in on that?
Well, because you're going to talk about it later. This is what I did. But gotcha. Even to do this, to even attempt to do this, people aren't, particularly early in loss, it's like, what are you doing here? Yeah. So that's just one example of that. I mean, I know. So here's an example for me. That probably it was September 92. And Josh was still okay. He had started to lose some of his left leg again, which made it harder for him to surf up in Nova Scotia.
Yeah.
And that was kind of a telltale to me. But he was still, by and large, doing good. He didn't have the drop foot yet. So it was probably, I can't remember, it was a Saturday, Sunday maybe. And it was a beautiful September day, just gorgeous, warm. I look out the front door, and there he is. He's out there on the grass on the side of the driveway, closest to the woody side, not the open side, Ben, if you mm-hmm. can think about it, but with all the rocks and the trees in those days. But he still had a view of the sky, and he's lying on his back, and he's just looking up with his hands behind his head, and he's waiting for his friends to show up. And I looked out there at that time, and I said to myself, what the hell is he thinking about? You know, what do you think he's thinking about? Well, almost to the day, the first year after that, I laid down in that position, and it just reminded me, he's not going to be doing this. He's not coming home.
Yeah.
But it was something I did, and I looked up, and I knew that day was puffy clouds, sort of your late summer puffy clouds. And I wanted to look into those clouds and see if I could see what he saw that day. Mm-hmm. But that's sort of an example that I came back to that acceptance that he wasn't coming up that driveway again.
Yeah. So expert companion, are you allowed to speak as to who your expert companion is, or do you have multiple and do you let them know, hey, you're my expert companion?
I mean, the only expert companion I'd tell anybody about is your mother.
Yeah.
And in some ways, we had different styles of grief. And this is where couples can have problems. You may not remember, Ben, when Josh died, we learned fairly quickly from Dana-Farber folks, and they had wonderful social workers working with people like us, that at that time it was a 90% divorce rate.
Wow.
Among couples who had lost kids like that. So you're in for something. I remember going down to Houghton's Hardware not long before Josh died, and I saw Dick Houghton, and his son had died of leukemia a few years earlier. Doug, I don't know, Mike, if you remember that, but
I do. Yeah.
And so someone told me you need to talk to Dick, and he was the owner. So I found it was a quiet moment, and I went over and said, someone told me I ought to talk to you about this. And he looked at me and he goes, is your marriage strong? And I was kind of taken aback. I said, yeah, I think so. He goes, well, sorry to get right to it, but it better be. Wow. And we learned, yeah, it better be. But mom is more of what was called an intuitive griever. So waves of effect, showing her emotions more and expressing the feelings, seeking my support. And sometimes maybe I wasn't in that moment. Mm-hmm. I'm more of an instrumental griever, that I'm going to process things in my own way and get busy. And to that extent, mom kept busy a lot. And so we went back and forth. And sometimes we were in different wavelengths. One was intuitive or emotional, and one was instrumental. And that can be problematic if you're not accepting of this difference. And the different approaches to grieving, I think, is what splits people up. And so you learn, I think one of the important things to learn is just don't judge. You don't want to judge people who are grieving. Everybody is going to have a different path. They all suck, but they're going to have a different path. And just try to, as best you can, empathize and be a good listener. But mom, for sure. I'm not sure we tried to burden you two, you and Nate, at all. You and I had some walks, Ben. We had. I'll never forget a walk early on, like the next morning. You and I, you may forget it.
I do. I think there's a lot. Yeah, there's a lot right after. You know, there's a lot that I probably should be, you know, writing letters to Josh and Nate and trying to process this. As I shared with Mike, you know, the age that I was at, and I think maybe Nate to an extent, but you know, we're both different. I just buried it. You know, you had us go to that support group at the church in Dover.
What a disaster. Well, it was in Exeter.
Exeter, yes. Yeah, I can't, you know, I've suppressed so much of it. Yes.
I can't blame you.
Well, yes and no. I mean, I looking back, I appreciate, one, the effort. I found myself in that first session, as you know, we're sitting around with kids kind of our same age, and everyone's lost someone, right? It wasn't that you necessarily lost a sibling. I think I recall it was like any everyone in that group is basically our age who've been through some sort of loss. And some of the stories from these kids around me were just horrifying. You know, parents died in a fire type situation. And I'm like, man, I don't know what I have. I can't relate to this person. Your loss is so much different than mine. And it was complete strangers. I was just not at a place where I wanted to, I didn't feel like I belonged there, which is a weird thing to think, but there I was. That's one. And then two, you know, that age, sophomore in high school, you just want normalcy. You know, you don't want to stand out for weird, you know, for odd reasons. And all of a sudden it was like, I was a kid who lost his brother and I just wanted a return to normalcy. And so I think that just meant like burying, you know, trying to bury it, and never, you know, properly processed. So,
well, and I think, and the mistake we made that I learned eventually dealing only with adults. One thing I know is I would never deal with kids or adolescents. That's a whole different area of grief. But what I did learn is that early on, in particular, people feel some link to others who have the similar kind of loss.
Yeah.
In other words, someone who lived with a spouse for 50 years and suddenly lost that spouse. Well, that is a terrible loss. I mean, it's just, but parents who just lost kids can't relate to that. And so there's a disconnect in sharing grief.
Yep.
So that's why I now run separate programs one for the most part. There are exceptions that I make for different reasons, but for the most part, for adults, and it's always adults, who have lost children or grandchildren or nieces, I don't see any difference there. And adults who have lost spouses or perhaps siblings or partners, because particularly early on, over time, I do think that those differences become less and less, mm-hmm. and they can share. Like spouses have said to mom and me, I don't know how you do it, how you could manage losing two, not one, but two children. And my response is, look, we had each other. And if I lost Donna suddenly, that's it. It's the Kool-Aid. Yeah.
So, answering machine. Everyone now has your recording. You don't have a personalized.
It's the landline.
Yeah.
And it's not my idea to have a landline.
Yeah. Oh, here we go. Folks.
Good thing the marriage is strong.
Let it out.
Listen, I want to be dad. I want to be your expert companion as you.
Thank you.
decompress these marital. You know what? Actually, don't get into it because I'm heading home there tomorrow and I don't want to. Don't bring me into the middle of your landline. You're right, though. I'm glad no one has a landline anymore, dad. Everyone has a cell phone.
One, two message.
I guess there's that, though. There's that moment of you have one new message. That's really bringing me back. That's a special thing. Listen, everyone, my dad is checking his messages on a podcast recording.
I'm trying to shut the darn thing off. And it's a new one that makes it even more frustrating.
Well, I'm glad that you finally updated your antiquated landline.
to the G5 or whatever it
there
is.
There it is. Yeah, there it is.
Sorry about that.
No. It's a moment of levity.
This will test your editing genius.
No, I'm going to leave that in. That's gold. let's have you real quickly. Where would I start? Like if I, you know, knowing that I haven't processed any of this stuff. I mean, I wouldn't say I haven't processed any of it, but Josh in particular, Nate, I was like, you know, I was sort of front and center on that whole experience.
Yes,
you know, being there with Mindy and, you know, that part, there was no running from. But Josh is just so buried. And so the work that Mike and I are doing on this podcast and the conversations that we're having around, you know, what makes you ill, what causes quote unquote disease. And we come back to things like toxic exposure, malnutrition, but stress and trauma keep coming up. And those are a little more difficult to pinpoint and assess and figure out how to even process that. So for my own sake, like I'm looking at it going, okay, this is clearly something I need to do or would like to do before I step foot into the grave is process this.
Sure. Let me give you two books.
I'm going to stop you because if one of them is why bad things happen to good people, you guys already tried that right after Josh died.
No, nope,
I think nope, I trashed
nope,
that.
No. That's a pretty good book.
I need to, the reason I threw it away is because it came from, I don't know if Jack Lyons gave it to me, but because it came from the church setting, I just wasn't, as I explained on the last episode, I sort of turned from God when Josh was diagnosed and I'm trying to repair that. Relationship. So I think maybe that would be a good book to read. But go on, suggest your two books, please.
Okay. But that is a good book. And it comes out of the book of Job, which is a wonderful reading.
Yeah.
Old Testament cool. As, and there's a lot about that. But one book is the Book of Joy. And this gets right into what you're talking about. So the Book of Joy, Lasting Happiness in a Changing World by the Dalai Lama and Desmond Tutu. And it comes out of, I think it's their third reunion across a number of years. And a writer named Douglas Abrams just wrote down the gist of their conversations. But there are, at the end, there are a number of wonderful exercises. And a lot of it grows out of Buddhist thought, But Desmond Tutu is so wonderful as well. And there's an old adage in this book, and this is what I think it gets to terrain theory too. Pain is inevitable. Suffering is optional. In other words, we all have feelings of pain and trauma, but suffering comes from the result of our response to that. And so what terrain theory, it seems to me, is getting at is, okay, we have agency. We have agency over our terrain, over our bodies, over our environment. And so that's where our response to our pain and suffering lie, right there. And Mike, it was something we learned in the graduate class. Leonard Cohen, one of the great writers of our era, ring the bell that still can ring. Forget your perfect offering. There's a crack in everything. That's how the light gets in. So we're all imperfect. We all have pain. We all have cracks. But those are opportunities for healing. And so in the Book of Joy, there are 8 pillars of joy. 4 are qualities of the mind: perspective, humility, humor, and acceptance. 4 are qualities of the heart: forgiveness, gratitude, compassion, and generosity. And the book is filled with discussions about this and exercises. And what the more I read about grief and healing, the more I see overlaps. So the other book, we can talk about some of the overlaps and why it all works for me, is a book by Jim Rendon. And it's called Upside, The New Science of Post-Traumatic Growth. And the basic question in this book, and it's sort of a Malcolm Gladwell book. Mm. In other words, it's based on little case studies as well as research findings. And it's a mashup, and it's wonderfully done. And I'm not as happy with Gladwell as I used to be, but this book, I think, it is the best approach of a Gladwell-type approach. And the core question is how people respond to seismic trauma in their life. So the case studies are rape victims, victims of the kind of traumatic loss that Ben suffered, military losses, multiple amputations. We know a number of these through Operation Hattrick and One Summit. And so here are the tools that come through from these case studies and science for people who, rather than spiraling down after traumatic seismic trauma or just muddling through, they actually grew. They found a way to grow. Deliberate rumination. In other words, you sit down and your mind's not just going over and over again. It's sitting down, thinking about this problem, but in the end, thinking about, okay, now what? Now what? And to me, that definitely links with the tasks. In other words, you're accepting this and you're beginning to process. That's deliberate rumination. So there you have two crossovers of the findings. The next, this is huge, relying on others, both for help and to give help. Relying on others. There's your expert companions. And in the case of, say, military losses, what is clear, and Ben knows this, what is clear is that the military people, they want to work together to work out their losses. This is why One Summit works so well.
Yeah.
A charity, Mike, you may know, started by one of Nate's good friends, that brings together Navy SEALs with kids fighting cancer. And the kids learn indoor rock climbing, to learn goal setting, resilience, that one more inch. But they're actually using one of the researchers from this Upside book to follow the seals, and they know all of this helps the seals maybe more than it helps the kids and their families. So relying on others, both for help and to give help, expert companion, honest communication. For me, that's journaling. So I'm writing to myself. I'm processing. This is task two, Ben. Mm-hmm. Processing the grief. This is where the letter, the unfinished business, and one of the approaches is writing a letter to your loved one and talking about what you did wrong, what they did wrong. That's processing. That's honest communication. Mm-hmm. Now, what I've learned from these grief groups, I'm a writer, but not everybody's a writer. So there are many ways to process all this. One of the wonderful people that died at 90 last year, who taught me so much, and she's the first one to challenge me, what if you're not a writer? Well, she was a woodworker. And then she became a flute player, learning native flutes, music, learning a new thing, mm-hmm. and working, processing her grief in these ways, art. We know Josh processed his trauma of dying through his art. I provided an example on the blogs last spring, I think. So deliberate rumination, relying on others, honest communication, positive outlook, book of joy, you know?
Yeah.
Faith. And in this case, what they know is that people who suffer seismic trauma often just throw out the orthodox faith that they grew up with. And then they come to grips with other faiths and they try to find something that works.
Is that because they feel betrayed by that faith, the original
faith? Yeah, I remember, Ben, you and I talked about another podcast that I listened to, something called the New Books Network. And it interviews typically scholars who have written new books in a variety of areas. And I was listening to one by a person who, he's not a Native American, but he's written a lot about Native American religion. And what he says is in these religions, he has what he thinks articulate the religions best in a small way, three Ps. All of these religions, and when you think about it, all religions seem to have this to some degree. Place, typically person, in this case, like a god or a mana or something, and process. There's the ritual. So if you go back into ancient religions, each place had some kind of person or association with it, some divine association, and then a process for interacting. And I think we all use that. Mm. That's what we do when we go up to the marginal way.
Sure.
There's a particular place. There's Josh. We have a process for dealing with that. So that's a form of faith. That's a spiritual element. I believe in all this. So I draw from all kinds of faiths. And then the last tool for resilience is new experience. A new experience. So it could be music. I remember Ben, and we'll get into this with the epilogue we have yet to write, is the Fender Telecaster. Mm. So when Josh died, we had the drum kit, we had the Fender, so I went out and bought a bass.
Yep.
And for me, struggling to learn the bass was a new experience that helped me process. And it made me feel close to Josh. So that new experience.
You know, that's interesting that you say that. I'd never even thought about picking up the drums. I really didn't play on those things while Josh was alive because they were his drum set. You know, I might bang on them here and there and then he'd grab the sticks. But after he passed, I really took to them. And I played them every day. Yeah, I'd come home from school and play the drums every day until I felt like I was pretty competent. I feel like maybe that was a way of connecting with him. I never even thought about that until this conversation. So thank you. Work is being done.
Ben, you were doing task four right there.
Task four, huh?
And don't think Mom and I didn't notice that.
Yeah.
if I was home, and often I taught at night or late afternoon, and at times I would be there when you got home, and the first thing you did was get on those drums and beat away.
Yeah.
We knew what was going on. Yeah. But I remember, and maybe we'll talk about it in the epilogue, I got, I guess, good enough. Good is probably too loose of a term, but I was competent enough that you and Jeff Lang
and Chris Davis
invited me to be the bass player for an unnamed band at the whatever senior.
No, it was just like a lunchtime performance in the cafeteria of the high school. We just played three covers.
Yeah. The Blitzkrieg Bop. I saw her standing there. And what was the third one?
Dire Straits. We played Sultans of Swing.
We played Sultans of Swing.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Chris made his way through those solos.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. No, I remember that. I remember that clearly. I also want to tie Nate into the drums real briefly. I remember one day, this was after Josh had passed, and Nate was, I must have been a senior, and Nate was a sophomore. So Nate was starting to, you know, he was less a boy, more a man, and he was getting into working out. And I walked into the basement, and he was pushing all the drums back so he could make room to work out. And I got so mad at him. We ended up actually having it out, like fist to the face type moment. And I remember that was one of the moments when I went, oh, he's not my little brother anymore. He's doing pull-ups and bench presses, and he's actually looking down on me. I think that was maybe one of the last times I got into a physical scuffle with Nate. But I was protective. He was moving those drums around. I think I just, something kicked in. I was like, you don't touch those. Those are Josh's drums. And likewise, I remember being very, very angry and felt betrayed when he moved into Josh's room. He moved out of his little room into Josh's room. And I was like, I guess I always envisioned that room being preserved as Josh's room. It made no sense. But to me, as a high school kid, sophomore, it did. I mean, I obviously like.
Well, but if that. I, let me jump in on that, though, to clarify something.
Yes,
well,
please do, historian father of mine.
Well, first, you may remember, I think the reason that you were protective of the drum kit and its place was that Josh actually wrote a will. We discovered after he died, and he said clearly he wanted that drum kit in the cellar.
Yeah.
He gave a lot of stuff away, but not that drum kit. And so that I agree with you on that one. On the room, you and I took a walk, that little walk, go down to Lang's, take a left, and then the first left. So it was a short walk. But Josh and I did that walk a lot toward the end of his life, just as he could, to keep moving.
Yeah.
Because as you know, when they're filling you with opioids for the pain, constipation is probably the worst thing you have to deal with. So we would go for that little walk. And I took you on that walk the morning after he died. That was more for me. I didn't tell you why. Maybe I did and you've forgotten it. But the next day, I think I took Nate on that walk. And the first thing he goes is, so Dad, when can I move into Josh's room? But just what you'd expect from an eighth grader.
Yeah.
And I understood that. And I said, we're not ready,
yeah,
Nate.
Yeah.
It's going to be a long time. And you know how long it was?
A year.
A year.
Yeah.
So he didn't move into that room for a year. So
yeah, well, it was still too soon.
cut him some slack.
I guess that's something I can write in a letter, the unfinished business.
I think it is unfinished business.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I appreciate you diving into all this stuff. Mike, anything you want to, you know, chime in about? I don't want to hog this whole thing.
Oh, you're not hogging it. I'm enjoying bearing witness to a lot of, again, with the blog, I learned a lot, or like maybe some things I had compartmentalized, or it was easier to not, you know, a lot of music from that time of my life too, I have a hard time listening to, even some of my favorite music, like Green Mind, Dinosaur Jr. Like Josh is wearing the Green Mind shirt through a lot of those videos in the blog. It's like, that music is so loaded for me, right? And to see them playing the wagon, like, I'd never seen that before. Ben, yeah. You had mentioned this. You hadn't, I guess you were manning the camera for a lot of that. So that's partly why you're not in a lot of the footage, I guess. But also, you know, it's hard to go back and watch some of that stuff. Sometimes, as like my romantic nature, I prefer to just like cherish the memory and not actually have to relive it. But to hear Josh's voice, something you said, Ben, like to hear his voice, and like Josh was a year older than me, right? And when you're at that age, like a year is, it's like a chasm, you know. Like last year, my son was dating, he was 14, he was dating a girl who was 16, and a friend of ours mentioned like, oh my God, at that age, it's a chasm. And I thought like, well, is it? Well, it is, right? And so like Josh being 1 year older than me, he was a big guy. That was the class I looked up to. And to hear his little voice in that video, like he's a kid.
Yeah.
His voice sounded so...
Yeah.
He sounded like a kid, which I had never... I'm 46 now. I never thought of Josh as a kid. I always thought of him as an upperclassman, my senior. And so that was really revealing. And a reminder that it's really important to go back and listen to Green Mind, to watch the videos, because it's who we are.
Well, there you get, and there you are, task two. So I don't know, Mike, if we sent you the playlist for Total Cruisin'.
Was it a Spotify playlist?
No. It was a mix. Josh loved to make mixes.
Yeah.
And he had a drawer in the, it was a set of drawers, a narrow one by his bed. And the top drawer was like, hands off, Nate.
Yeah.
Don't you dare go in there. That's where we found his will.
Yeah.
The reason we did, we were thinking about what music would make sense for the memorial service that was going to be a week later. We wanted to have music. We wanted it to be for the kids. And I found this mix, Total Cruisin'. And I think someone told me they heard it once on the way to surf. And I put it up on a blog,
yeah,
one of the blogs about Josh and music. And so my mother was still alive, and periodically I'd go down to see her outside of Boston in the home she was living in. My father died suddenly 2 weeks after Josh died.
Mm.
I don't think I've ever gotten to grieve for him.
Right.
But I, on the way down to visit my mother, I would deliberately play that all the way back and forth. And I'd just cry like a baby.
Yeah.
For these songs. And so they're in my mind like the Mundas.
Yeah.
The Mundas summer song. I can play that now on my iPod and just cry. And it's not a bad thing, I don't think.
No, it's catharsis.
I'm still processing the grief.
You know, I have two stories to share now that my mind is moving. On January 5th, you know, the eve before Josh passed, I was in your neighborhood. I was at Rob Martin's house rehearsing, I imagine, with Aqua Velvet, the jazz trio, jazz quartet that ended up playing at the memorial service.
Yep.
And I had been visiting Josh semi-regularly, you know, in those months, weeks leading up to his death, sitting by the bedside, talking about music or whatever we were talking about. And I remember leaving the Martins home. And do I go left to Bartlett or do I go right to my house? And going through that process. And it's hard to know how cognizant I was of how imminent Josh's passing would be. I mean, this was clearly within hours, right? And I knew somehow intuitively, I can't go over there tonight, right? But that is etched in my memory as that moment sitting in that driveway when he was actually close to crossing over. And I always meant to share that with you guys. I don't think I ever did. And then just somehow a closure that band that we were rehearsing with that night ended up being part of the ceremony, the memorial, sort of some sort of cosmic bookend. Mm-hmm. But another story, we have close friends, a woman Ruthie grew up with. They lost their firstborn, basically during childbirth, and have been going through years and decades of grieving, and it's messy. And because they're such close friends of the family, we bear witness to a lot of their process. But early on, they were going to sort of a spiritual healer to help, because the child never actually breathed on his own. This healer was working with the idea that the soul was never allowed to leave the mother's body because it never was able to breathe on its own. And so there was part of the child stuck in the mother still. And so he was going to help her through that process to release the spirit from her so she could move on. And I'm shooting from the hip here a little bit. I don't know all the inner workings of that process. But we went to visit them. They were out in California at the time. Ruthie got it in her because the experience was so positive for our friend. She thought, well, you guys should try this too. This guy's great, right? And it's by donation. And so Ruthie went, had a really positive experience. She said, you got to do this. You should go. So I went, and no expectations. And he started asking me questions and sort of like honing in on people I had lost in my life. And I lost my grandfathers both at age 10. I imagine we spoke about that. This is, you know, 15, 20 years ago. But one thing I did bring up, the Hardys, at some point, I must have. And I didn't reveal many details, but he said, did your friend, I think I brought up Josh in particular, and he said, did your friend die in a violent way? And I said, no, but his brother did. And he said to me, his brother came looking for Josh in you, because when Josh passed, I held on to him very hard. In fact, I used to think, well, I have said frequently, the only reason I had the courage to become an artist was because of the wind Josh put in my sails, that I had him to push against. I had not just the lessons, and I like that Earl says, like, he thinks it's funny that we think of Josh as a teacher. Josh would have never thought of himself as a teacher. And I don't really think of him as a teacher, but just like that point in my life, seeing how it can be, how it can go, that life can be ripped out from under you sort of without notice, it just gave me that resolve. But as a result, I sort of like clutched Josh's identity within me. I even thought that's why I look so young still. I'm 46. I look like I'm 30 all the time. I think it's because I was harboring a teenager within me. It helped keep me visually youthful. I think there's something to that. And the idea that I was clutching Josh so vigorously that Nate came to me to look for him actually made a lot of sense. And this healer, Peter, sort of helped me loosen my grip and not necessarily have to harbor them as some sort of protective identity mechanism. So I could truly like maybe grow up a little bit and be myself.
It makes perfect sense to me, Mike. See, this whole notion of the spiritual aspects of healing, we have to be open, very open. And I don't think any single Orthodox religion can cover what we need to think about for healing.
Yeah.
I'll give you an example. I mean, we call them gifts. So you got this gift from Josh, if you will. I'll just give you one little story. After Nate died, we went down to Virginia Beach. Mindy's family stayed in their house. So the Team Six put us up in a what was really intended to be a summer place on the beach. Navy people would get them. There were probably four or five of them on this area down there on the beach near the base. And there nobody's down there in February, but it was winterized, so we were in there. And Ben ended up staying with Mindy. And I, you know, this is the moment after Nate's death that Ben stepped up and he took over. This is the moment he took over. It's like, okay, I did this with Josh.
Yeah.
Ben's ready to do this for Nate. And wow, Wow, was he good, huh?
Yeah,
go to YouTube, folks, and watch Ben give a eulogy to his brother.
Yeah.
But the last morning we were there before we were going to head to really D.C. for the burial and then home from D.C., we would take a run on the beach. Beautiful. It happened that the weather was very, very nice down there in Virginia Beach, as it can be in February. So I'm running along the beach this last morning, and I'm running into a slight wind. And suddenly beside me, no more than 3 feet to my left, is a big seagull just going with me. And I turn, and the seagull turns and looks me straight in the eye. It's like Nate saying, "Dad, I'm okay."
Yeah.
And we have had so many experiences like this, and we know so many friends who have had experiences like this after loss, that we just say, these are gifts.
Yeah.
Stay open to them. You can't chase them, but when you get them, as you did from Josh, stay open to them.
Yeah. Keep the channel open.
Keep the channel open. Absolutely.
You know, when, so I have a lot of songs that I wrote right around that time, Nate passed, and sort of like you just said, you never really got to grieve for your father because it happened in such close proximity to Josh's passing. Similarly, my son was born the same week that Nate passed. And it really, I think I used to talk about this a lot more closer into those times because I was writing songs about it and they were on albums and it was part of our show. It was part of our banter. It was part of the stories, me contextualizing those songs, celebrating the arrival of firstborn and simultaneously grieving a dear friend. It was, they seemed to be at odds with each other, right? But that trip down to Arlington, I used to joke on stage, I'd sort of make light of it, that our son, Willie, who's now 14, was on tour his whole life, right? But the very first trip he made was to Arlington National Cemetery as a two-week-old. If I'm not mistaken, I mean, he was a newborn, right? And Parker was there as maybe a six-month-old or so.
Yeah, seven-month-old.
Yeah.
I remember going into the reception back at the hotel and seeing you and Ruthie and Willie.
Yeah.
There. Yeah.
Yeah. And meeting Parker for the first. And then when I went to greet you at the cemetery, I remember what you said was, "Here's my grandson." You were putting Parker in a car seat or taking him out, and you were just so proud of your grandson. I mean, in a way that I'll never see another grandfather be proud of a grandson under the context of it all. You know, at the cemetery, it was a moment.
Yeah. When we go. It's cascaded. There are so many more seals we visit from the time Nate and Mike were there. And it can fall, it'll all fall down on you, but it's task four. It's a ritual. Continue that relationship. And then typically we'll go to a museum. So we're moving forward in life while maintaining relationship with Nate, and it's a good thing. It's a good thing.
Pops, while we have you, we wanted to shift gears really, really quickly. And you are a historian, specifically a sports historian, but you're a historian. I think you have an encyclopedic brain.
For better or worse.
And we, in this space, in this terrain theory space, Mike and I find ourselves having conversations with folks and falling into circles where people who are questioning germ theory, which is like the predominant paradigm, end up saying similar things, and that is, well, if we've been lied to about this thing, what else have we been lied to about? Or if they're wrong about this, what else are they wrong about? They, we can just put in quotes, and it makes us think a lot about history. A lot of these folks now, everything's on the table. Like everything is on the table. All of history is on the table. We see evolution questioned. We see folks wanting to turn back to the Bible and take it literally, or look at the Bible and say it's all analogy for this, that, and the other. And as a historian, we think about maybe two famous quotes. One would be Voltaire, the French writer, "History is the lie commonly agreed upon." And then the second, which gets misattributed to Churchill, "History is written by the victors." And I wonder, as a historian, how do you approach that discipline without doubt? How do you approach that discipline and not take on faith the primary sources that you accumulate to tell the story or piece together a puzzle? Or do you just take it on faith that this thing that you found as a primary source, or these texts that have come before you by other historians that build upon this knowledge and history, are indeed fact? Or do you look at it all with a grain of salt and say, who really knows?
That's a great question, Ben. I would say offhand that from my graduate training in history, and I have a master's degree in American history, and had a number of doctoral seminars with doctoral students in history, trying to learn how to do the craft. And then from the long years of writing and working in archives and also teaching students how to do research. If there's two things, there's another famous quote about history by a philosopher, George Santayana. One thing we've learned from history is that we don't learn from history. but one thing that a good historian has learned is to question sources, interrogate sources. No good historian is going to take a source and use it without interrogating it and trying to find some corroboration for that. Mm. We know, for instance, I mean, look, my favorite is, if you use a memoir as a source, mm-hmm. you better be really careful, right? There's an obvious reason someone writes a memoir.
Yeah.
and my favorite example is, I can't remember which basketball player it was, but wrote a memoir. And when it came out, and some of the outrageous things were quoted in the memoir, the player said to the media, "I never wrote that. This is your own memoir, buddy." So what does that tell you about the authenticity and veracity of that memoir? And on and on. And so even when you're in the archives, which for a historian, that's like the place to be. And you find some discovery that is holy mackerel, you still have to be careful with it. You still have to interrogate it. Who wrote it? What's the context of this? Who was the intended audience? So you learn how to interrogate sources and not accept them ever immediately at face value. Mm-hmm. And so one of the problems with so-called science these days is the media misuse of so-called science. And that is this, that science, so-called science, is never intended to move on the basis of one study. It's intended, like normal science, Ben Kuhn, Structures of Scientific Revolutions. Mm-hmm. Normal science works on accretions of evidence and one study after another. The problem, particularly emanating from universities, is that if a scientist at a university has a study that's come out and finds something that seems different, the university is going to blab it everywhere, because that one of the growth areas of universities is the PR operation. Everyone's trying to get PR. And so that gets out in the media and then gets multiplied and multiplied and multiplied as if it's the reality. It's not. It's one finding. And so we've lost our ability to interrogate sources, and social media have made that even worse. May I give one, my favorite Voltaire story?
Please.
So this is probably apocryphal, but it's a great story. It captures Voltaire. So Voltaire, the great philosopher, is on his deathbed, right? And they call, because he grows up a Catholic and they want him to be honored properly, they call in the priest, and probably who knows, the bishop or the cardinal, to do the last rites. And at some point in the last rites, the priest says, "And now will you renounce the devil?" And Voltaire says, "Is this a time to make enemies?" Always questioning.
Always questioning.
You reminded me of one of my favorite quotes that's sort of born of show business. And I forget exactly who said it. It might have been Sammy Davis Jr. or something. He said, "This business is all about authenticity." Or maybe he said sincerity. "This business is all about sincerity. If you can fake that, you've got it made."
There you go.
Even that deathbed, it's great that you bring up the deathbed, Voltaire's deathbed statement, because how do we even know that that was real? And I ask that because in these terrain theory circles, folks like to point to Louis Pasteur and say on his deathbed, he said, "The germ is nothing, the terrain is everything." And who's to say whether he said that or not? I mean, unless you have video evidence, and even that at this point, it can be faked.
Right.
Folks will adopt it because it's convenient. And it's a great, as you said, Dad, a great story about Voltaire.
And you know that old saying, never let the truth get in the way of a good story.
And maybe that's where we are.
Well, maybe, but to question sources is the most important thing.
Yeah. All right.
Question the sources. And I think what you two are doing is you're slowly building a body of knowledge. And that's important. And the more you listen to the podcast, the more I listen to the podcast, the more I'm seeing overlap.
Hmm.
And that's important too. So there's something going on, but it's a long process. You're at the very beginning here.
It is. It is a long process. And I'm thankful I have my expert companion in Mike Miranda.
Yes. Your expert companions for expert each other. Companion.
Well, Pops, let's bring this episode in for the landing, and we'll ask you the same question we ask everyone. What are your non-negotiables, those habits that you do every day to tend to your terrain?
And I will give them as long as you promise to tell your mom what your non-negotiables will be this Thanksgiving.
Deal.
Okay, because she needs to cook.
Yeah.
Okay, so I thought about this beforehand. Here's one that you two have had a profound impact on. So we bought a form of a water filter. One of those pitchers, a pure, however you pronounce it. And so that's a start. And we're religious about that. For me, in the morning especially, I'll have a little bit of kombucha, Gingerade, Mike.
Yeah, my fave.
Kombucha, and then the filtered water.
Mm-hmm.
And that, I believe that has an impact. I find myself cleaning out
mm-hmm.
better. My kidneys seem to be working better.
Mm-hmm.
For me, for a long time, some form of exercise or stretching, that's a non-negotiable. Some form of writing or processing. My world around me and my own problems. Here's another one, you guys. If possible, the sun. Without sunscreen on my head. Mm. And I feel safer since I've had two melanomas. I do feel safer about it this time of year. Mm-hmm. So I'll take my walk with my hat off and enjoy that sun. And I believe that makes a difference. And finally, to practice gratitude, one of those pillars of joy. And in that book, they say, acceptance means not fighting reality. Gratitude means embracing reality. It means from counting your burdens to counting your blessings. And so if you guys would indulge me, I'll share with you a modified Buddhist tonglen, I think is the word, or meditation of gratitude.
Please do.
If you want to work with me, and we can do this.
Please
and,
do.
Something I try to do as often as I remember. Okay, so you sit comfortably. Close your eyes if you want, or not, or center. And then as you learn the breathing a few episodes ago, nose breathing, belly breathing, in, hold if you'd like, exhale, breathe in, hold if you'd like, exhale, just relax, and then think of a problem you're facing. Think of a problem that you're facing as you breathe in and breathe out. A problem in your life. And then if you can, think of one or two things that friends or loved ones have taught you that might help you address and solve this problem in your life right now. Something from a friend or a loved one that might help you solve this problem. Breathing in, breathing out. And then be grateful for that lesson that you've learned from a friend or a loved one. Be grateful. And finally, think about the ways this problem may have actually been contributing to your life and your growth, that you're growing from a problem. Good way to practice gratitude.
That's great. I appreciate that, Pops.
Yeah, thank you for that.
And I'm grateful for you two guys.
Very grateful for you.
Grateful and honored to be on the podcast.
Well, last note then, how can the listener learn a little bit more about Stephen Hardy?
So you mentioned it early, my website that Ben helped me set up where I have my blogs and other bits of writing. Stephen Hardy Writer, all one word, Stephen with a PH, StephenHardyWriter.com.
That's awesome. Stephen Hardy, Pops, thanks for joining us on the Terrain Theory Podcast.
Thank you both. Have a blessed Thanksgiving.
Yeah, maybe I'll pop in on you guys again. I hope I can.
Wonderful. That was great.
Yeah.
That was great.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Now it's time for the after party. Come and join us in the Pioneer Room. Come and join us in the Pioneer Room.
Welcome to the after party in the Pioneer Room with your two co-hosts, Mike Miranda and Ben Hardy, myself, Mike. I guess I shouldn't ask, what'd you think of Steve Hardy? Because you've known him for a long time.
I love your dad so much. I know. It's like a family reunion.
You know, one thing that, I won't say I'm surprised. It shouldn't have surprised me at all, but he was so prepared.
Oh, my. Well, you know what was not revealed to me, but I was reminded of that we are very clearly the offspring of professors.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. He was prepared to give a lecture on grief and grieving, or class, as it were.
Yeah. It was actually very impressive. And I about halfway through, I was like, holy shit, is he just doing all of this by heart? Like the bullet points. And then I realized, okay, he's prepared like a professor would be. He's got his notes up on his screen and he's, yeah. Like
however,
he's giving it like we were in class.
I will tell you, yes, he's prepared, but I will also tell you that much of what he said to us. Yeah. I've seen him spit off in random conversation without like a you know, note cards. So this is just his brain. I'm envious. I wish I had his brain.
Well, his ability to retain knowledge. You must have it in ways that maybe haven't revealed themselves to you. Come on, how could you not?
Yeah, when it comes to details about fake moon landings, maybe, but okay. I appreciate you. I mean, this is sort of indulging me bringing my dad on. So I appreciate you kind of indulging. But I think
feel like an indulgence. In fact, I guess it came up with the Nicholas Keen conversation, how we haven't spent as much time exploring mental health. And this seems part and parcel of that plank of health, right? Because it's health. It's just health.
It's just health.
On a more like fun note, I just wanted to mention early on here, I sometimes forget, because your family lived in so many places when you were young, right? West Coast and Pittsburgh and Cape Cod, but that your dad is from Waltham, Mass, Boston. And I never picked up on his Boston accent before, ever. Like your mother and memoir and stuff like that.
I guess it does come out, doesn't it?
Yeah. I never heard it till then. That really made me smile, because that's you know, my family's all Boston as well.
That's hilarious. I don't even notice it. It's just what I'm around. My mother, it's way more pronounced in my mother.
Yeah. Yeah. So cool. Well, you know, folks, if you don't know, so Ben and I both, our fathers were both professors at UNH, and not a small thing. That's why we know each other. That's why we ended up growing up in the same town, and largely why our brains work the way they do, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, I would agree. It's sort of interesting when he said it's all about not having judgment. You know, when you look at someone, their grief process, and that made me think back to our conversation with Steve Hart. Remember Steve Hart, the sound healer?
Yeah.
And the interesting thing about Steve is that, and this is actually something I really wanted to bring him back on to talk about, is Steve went through some significant loss in his life. So he lost his mom, and I don't know how long it was. It wasn't very long ago. And then more recently lost his fiance. So he was engaged to be married. She was diagnosed with cancer and then lost her. So he's been through some pretty significant losses, two very distinct losses. And if you watch him, if you follow him on social media, he's so open about the process. In fact, I feel like he's slowly becoming a person that others can turn to, almost as like as a thought leader in the space of grief. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to bring him on, but it was just interesting that my dad, you know, mentioned no judgment, not having judgment. And that was a big, big piece of what Steve was talking to us about, you know, not having judgment.
Yeah, boy, and that could be applicable to society at large, just beyond grief in this day and age. There's so much judgment, thought policing going on.
Yeah.
You know, my story about that, a really powerful lesson I learned was we were on tour like 2011 or so through Canada in a town called Revelstoke. This was a like 12 shows in 14 days. Most of them were house concerts, but some of them were like hotel lobbies. And but when you do 12 shows in 14 days, inevitably you're playing like Tuesday nights and Wednesday nights in rural Canada. And this particular night was one of those. And there was like 4 or 5 people there. Just like one of those embarrassing nights where it's like hard to feel like you're actually doing a show when the audience is so modest. And there's this, when the audience is so modest, you are hyper aware of how each individual is responding. There's no being like lost in anonymity in the crowd. And there's this one audience member who wouldn't clap. It's like, oh my God, you guys, there's 4 people here. And like one dude, you're just going to sit there with your arms folded over your chest. And it's like impossible not to judge that person as the performer. And have a vibe about that person. And at the break, I don't even know why we did 2 sets. It's like, why do you take a break and then come back for more when it's such a small crowd? Or maybe it wasn't even the break. Maybe it was after the show. I don't remember. That dude bought one of every album.
Oh.
Right? Whatever we had on the table, like 3 or 4 or 5 albums.
Wow.
And I started talking to him turns out he was in town for his mother's funeral. And happened to see that there was a show and came, but clearly was not, he was not in a normal state of mind where I'm a music fan. I'm going to go see, like, lighthearted, go see a concert. He was grieving.
Yeah.
And I was judging his response to me from, like, an egotistical place. But now with that new information, it's like, what a powerful thing that he was taking in my music, really as evidenced by the fact that he left with all of our albums. There was something healing about the experience that he couldn't, nor should he have been able to, express in that moment.
Well, remember what Covell and Smokey both say: this is medicine. This music is healing music.
You know what's funny? I was looking at the Mammals Instagram page like yesterday, like at the little bio. You know, you have like X amount of characters. You know what it says there? I changed it to medicinal music at some point. don't remember doing that, but yeah, there it was.
There it is.
Yeah.
Music was such a big part of, Josh's journey and the healing from that. And like you, I have the strongest of emotions when I listen to The Wagon by Dinosaur Jr. But the one that I find myself playing, it's not like I play it every month, but I'll go through a stretch where I'll just play it every day, is Chant a Psalm by Stiles.
Such a positive vibe too, right?
Yeah, and that was played. That was one that was played at his memorial. I wonder, maybe I'll put up the playlist to the Total Cruisin' mix. Mixtapes were like the thing, right? Yeah. When we were in high school, mixtapes were the thing. It's what you would make for like the girl you had a crush on.
Yeah,
it was better than a love letter. It's like, I'm going to say it through song. And Josh's Total Cruisin' mix is a teen facing his death.
Yeah,
and it's in there. It's all in there. There's a song, I can't remember who sings it. Drifting on an ocean till you die. And it's like, I can't listen to that mix without just being in his feet, in his footsteps.
Yeah.
Facing this thing through music. Like, this was how he conversed. This is how he experienced the world. His emotions were all tied up in the music that he listened to. And this is what he poured in, as almost as like, this is my message to everybody.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I love that bit in the blog where Nate went to join Josh in his bedroom. And I forget that you guys are like all brothers with all the entanglements of sibling, the fisticuffs and snippiness and you can be here, but as long as you don't talk, Shit. No one escapes any of those paradigms. But just, I think it was like listening to the Ska Bonanza set and Josh permitted Nate to be there as long as he didn't talk. And this is should be obvious, I think, but worth mentioning, so you would go home and pound on the drums. Like, I didn't really ever put two and two together, but that makes a hell of a lot of sense. I know that you've always been sort of humble about your drumming prowess, but I always thought you were a great drummer. By extension, though, like, that really parlayed into the band that we started as a continuation of, think it's lost on us that was a way to grieve and celebrate Josh, right? That whole enterprise. And then the act of rehearsing and pursuing it for, not long enough, but those years, that was a ritual.
Yeah, you're 100% correct. The starting a ska band, keeping that going, and the ties that we had with like Rock Bottom Records,
right?
It's like Josh's favorite place in Portsmouth to go, and had such a great relationship with the owner, and the owner, developed this relationship with the family, and like we sort of kept that up through Scarotum and the ska band and playing in Portsmouth all the time. That was 100% like keeping Josh alive. I'm so glad we had this conversation. So much of this is like I'm seeing for the first time through this lens. So
all part of the process that you as we spoke about in the last chat last week, is like you're ready to take this on. This is just another step down this journey, this healing journey for you.
Yeah. Well, Mike, are we going to see you over Thanksgiving?
I suspect so. We'll be in Durham with the whole fam, the kids, and Ruthie's folks will be with us as well. Leaving Wednesday, and so I think last year we connected Friday. Is there going to be another turkey bowl?
Haven't heard a thing, but it's never too late to try.
Yeah. Well, I think you can count on seeing certainly me, and I'll try and scare up some more rest of the family. I know that your folks would probably love to see the kids and Ruthie. So.
Yeah, I know Grayson is already talking about seeing Opal again.
Oh, good. Now we'll see each other.
I love it. All right. Well, folks, nothing you heard here today should be taken as medical advice, as neither Mike nor I are medical experts. We hope you all have a wonderful holiday weekend to those who are celebrating it. And remember that you are light, and you are love, and you are your primary healthcare provider. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll catch you on the next one.